David went to fight wherever Saul sent him. He was very successful, so Saul put him in charge of the soldiers. This pleased everyone, even Saul's officers. David would go out to fight against the Philistines, and on his return, women in every town in Israel would come out to meet him. They sang and danced for joy as they played their tambourines and lyres. The women sang, "Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed tens of thousands." This song upset Saul, and he became very angry. Saul thought, "A little more of this, and they will give him the kingdom itself." So from that time on, Saul watched David very closely. The next day, an evil spirit from God took control of Saul, and he went wild in his house. David played the harp to calm him, as he usually did, but Saul had a spear in his hand. He thought, "I'll pin David to the wall." Saul threw the spear twice, but David jumped out of the way both times. The Lord had left Saul and was now with David, so Saul was afraid of David. Saul sent David away and made him a commander over 1,000 soldiers. This put David out among the men even more as they went into battle and returned. The Lord was with David, so he was successful in everything. Saul saw how successful David was and became even more afraid of him. But all the people in Israel and Judah loved David because he was out among them and led them into battle. People told Saul that his daughter Michal loved David. This made Saul happy. He thought, "I will use Michal to trap David. I will let Michal marry David, and then I will let the Philistines kill him." So Saul commanded his officers to speak to David in private. He told them to say, "Look, the king likes you. His officers like you. You should marry his daughter." Saul also told them, "Say this to David. David, the king doesn't want you to pay money for his daughter. He wants to get even with his enemy. So the price for marrying his daughter is 100 Philistine foreskins." That was Saul's secret plan. He thought the Philistines would kill David. So Saul's officers told this to David. David was happy that he had a chance to become the king's son-in-law. So immediately he and his men went out to fight the Philistines. They killed 200 Philistines. David took these Philistine foreskins and gave them to Saul. Saul saw that the Lord was with David. So Saul became even more afraid of David and was against him all the time. Just a few more verses that I just want to put on the screen because I want to think about jealousy or envy this morning, if you would just put those up. Then I thought, why do people work so hard? I saw people try to succeed and be better than other people. They do this because they're jealous. They don't want other people to have more than they have. This is madness. It's like trying to catch the wind. A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. Anger is cruel and can destroy like a flood, but jealousy is much worse. And then one more slide. If you're selfish and harbour jealousy in your hearts, you have no reason to boast. Such an attitude doesn't come from God, it comes from the world. Where there is jealousy and selfishness, there will be confusion and every kind of evil. Now, over these next 2 weeks, I want us to look at two key people in the early years of David, before he became king. In Saul's Jonathan, you will encounter an Old Testament version of John the Baptist, happy to further David's career at the expense of his own. But in Saul himself, you are forced to reflect on what jealousy can do to a person. Jealousy or envy is a common theme in Scripture. It's there in the Ten Commandments, of course. Of all the commandments that could have been put, the last one, you will not covet, or you will not be jealous of the things that your neighbour has. But it's also there in early Genesis, the story of Cain and Abel, where Abel's sacrifice is pleasing to the Lord, and Cain, in a great feeling of envy, takes his brother's life. And then you get it again very shortly afterwards in the story of Joseph. Joseph, the one favoured by his father, and the brother's angry because he's just the younger one. And so they decide to try and kill him. Fortunately, Joseph's life is spared, and you know the rest of the story, how he rises to power in Egypt. And then the enemies of Jewish leaders like Daniel, who as a result of their envy finished up in a lion's den, and Nehemiah, as he tried to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, the surrounding neighbours tried to stop him as much as they could. And looking beneath their public personas, you invariably find people constantly comparing their fortunes to the fortunes of others. And as the proverb says, it rots the bones. What a lovely phrase that is. I can remember going to hear Billy Graham years and years ago. And Billy Graham, I think in every sermon that I ever heard Billy preach, he used the same verse, but it's such a good verse. And it reads really well in the old versions as well. Jeremiah 17, verses 9 and 10. And he used to bring this into every sermon. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Isn't that an interesting phrase, desperately wicked? The other translations kind of soften that in some way, but I've always been struck by that language. Now, David had just killed Goliath, and in the process had become a national hero. Whereas Saul had forfeited God's anointing, David was riding the crest of a wave. Saul was completely unaware of that story in 1 Samuel 16 about how David, from his family, was anointed by Samuel. But from this point, everything that David touched seemed to turn to gold. Meanwhile, Saul was plagued by an evil spirit sent by God. Don't ask me exactly what that means, because you can read endless commentaries and come out none the wiser. But we do know that it was David's music, ironically, that was the thing that soothed him. And so in the middle chapters of 1 Samuel, there is this shift. God transfers his blessing from King Saul to this young man, David. And it says in verse 10 of this chapter we've just read, Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left him. And from the moment David killed Goliath, his star began to rise. He became popular in the king's court with the king's generals. The people loved him. And even Saul's children adored him, all except for Saul himself. He simply became jealous. On two occasions, he tried to kill David with his javelin. And as you read the story on, eventually David had to flee for his life and was forced to become a fugitive for many years. Now, if you read the chapter carefully, and you will have picked it up a little bit as we read it just then, in 1 Samuel 18, the narrator is driving certain points home by the repetition of certain words. He uses the word success exclusively of David. He repeatedly says that David was loved by a whole variety of people, his son Jonathan, Saul's son Jonathan, Saul's daughter Michal, and by the common people and by the officers in the army. Three times the narrator tells us that the Lord was with David. He's just emphasizing and emphasizing the shift that has taken place. And so envy begins to creep in. When you think about envy, it's an interesting thing. I like jazz, as some of you know, and I'm absolutely amazed at the speed with which some jazz musicians can just move their fingers. And I'm particularly interested in piano because I play piano, but cannot play anything like that. Wish that if I'd had my time again, I would have worked harder. But I was reading that there are kind of three reactions. One reaction when you hear a piece of music that's really well played is just to like it, admire it, you know, play it over and over. Another reaction is if you're a musician yourself, you try to improve and try to play like that. It's called what the psychologists call a benign envy. You don't bear any bad will towards the person, but you try and kind of learn from what they're able to do. But the third reaction is something far more destructive, where I recognize that the other pianist is better than me and wish that something bad would happen to him, like he loses fingers or something like that. Nasty, isn't it? But that's where envy can sometimes take you. And it was this destructive envy which took control of Saul, so that Saul wanted to remove David completely from the nation's life. I've mentioned before the famous film that came out back in the 1980s about Mozart. Mozart was an absolute genius of a musician. Apparently composed his first concerto at the age of four. died at the age of 38, but in between produced the most incredible music. He was gifted. It's like the Lord was with him. But in the film, it does an interesting thing. It doesn't just tell the story. It picks up on another great musician, but not as great as Mozart. Somebody in the king's court, somebody who was composing music, but none of it as memorable as Mozart. His name was Salieri. We don't know the exact details of their relationship, but the film tries to use Salieri as a kind of foil for talking about envy. Now, there was a rumour, actually, that Salieri poisoned Mozart, and that's why he died so young. Nobody's sure about that. But when you watch the film and you see the sheer frustration of Salieri when he composes a new piece for the king and he plays it, and Mozart is standing by, and he plays this very long piece of music, and then the king turns to Mozart and says, well, that's very good. And what do you think of it, Mozart? And Mozart said, yeah, it's all right. No, he said, what do you really think of it? And Mozart said, well, I think there's a couple of things that could be improved. And he then sits down at the piano and he reproduces, without looking at any music, the whole of the piece of music that's just been played. And then stops at one point and says, but rather than do this, I think you could do that. And it just sounds a little bit better. And then does the same again. And you can see Salieri becoming more and more frustrated. And why has God given this guy this amazing ability that makes me look so small and stupid? And in the final scene, you see Salieri as an old man, Mozart long since dead. And Salieri rails against the curse of mediocrity, his whole life eaten up with his bitterness and with his envy for Mozart. Now, the first thing you need to realise is that nobody feels jealous of everyone. Jealousy is much more subtle than that. I watch a lot of sport and I admire athletes, but I'm not consumed with jealousy every time somebody breaks a world record. You know, I just think that's great and it's nice to watch it. I'm not consumed with jealousy about that at all. I think politicians are amazing at manoeuvring themselves out of tight corners. I can remember once Simon Hughes, who was a local MP in South London, the Liberal Democrats took power from the Labour Party. The Labour mayor turned his colours midway through his term of office, and that he had two votes, and it was a very sort of close council, Southwark Council, and he gave his vote to the Liberal Democrats, and they took power. And the first thing they did was to cut funding to various groups. And at Christmas, one of the groups that had had its funding cut invited Simon Hughes, who was a Liberal Democrat MP, to come along and explain why it was that they'd had their funding cut. Now, I'm amazed. I mean, a couple of us were there and we thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. Simon Hughes got up and he spoke for 5 minutes. And at the end of it, he was applauded by this group who were having their funding cut. Just extraordinary what politicians can do. The way they maneuver themselves out of tight spots, I never understand it. But I really don't envy them their job. I wouldn't want to be a politician. Thanks very much. And seeing Theresa May and how hard she's tried to get this deal sorted, and maybe she's been a bit stubborn, and maybe she hasn't listened enough, and maybe she should have got the opposition around the table earlier and all of that stuff. But who'd be a politician who really would want to do that? I don't feel envious. But the people I do feel jealous of are the people who do similar stuff to what I do, but they do it a whole lot better. Now that is really, really annoying. I get jealous of ministers who can just wander around without any notes at all, and they've spent half the time that I've spent in preparation, but they're so much more engaging, you know, you're laughing, you're really kind of with them. Oh, it does my head in, you know. Why did you call me to this job, Lord, when I can't do it as well as this lot can? You know, it's just so, so annoying when that happens. And you must have similar things as well, where you sort of connect in life with other people, and that's when it makes you jealous. Perhaps you're a mother, but someone else's children are doing better than yours, or they're better behaved. You know, all that kind of stuff, and it really irritates you, doesn't it? Because it's not that you're doing anything wrong, but then people kind of judge you on it, and all that sort of stuff. Or somebody else at work has been promoted ahead of you. or been given a higher bonus when they've been in the job less time. It just kind of niggles, doesn't it? It's not that you feel jealous of everyone. It's just these people who kind of connect with you in life. And so here is Saul, the king, the man everyone is supposed to look up to and respect. But there's a new kid on the block who's commanding more love and devotion and respect than Saul is. And those words, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s, were probably a jubilant song spontaneously composed for the occasion. And nobody particularly wanted to rubbish Saul and say that he was a lousy king, but they did want to encourage David. But nonetheless, Saul internalized it all and it began to eat away inside him. He began to see things that weren't there. David must be plotting to overthrow him. And so instead of going out to fight the Philistines, his enemies, he started chasing his own countrymen all over the country. And there are endless chapters in 1 Samuel about Saul chasing David to try and kill him. The Philistines didn't need to worry too much for a period of time. Israel, it seemed, was now bent on self-destruction. A heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. So much in life, it seems, is driven by pride and envy. Instead of getting on with life and doing something useful, we use pride and envy as motivators. Even businesses do that. There's a thing in business that started to emerge about 20 years ago called stack ranking, or otherwise known as the vitality curve, where businesses would begin to measure the productivity of their workers. So stack ranking is where an employee's performance is ranked against that of his colleagues. It's supposed to raise standards in the organization, but in practice, it led to a very negative competition between colleagues. So if one particular colleague was doing well and wanted some information, you'd kind of be a bit slow getting the information over to them. Or you'd prevent certain tasks from being completed through deliberate obstruction or non-cooperation. It was used by many big companies for a while, like Microsoft, for example, but they abandoned it in about 2013 because they found that what the effect of this particular method was, that it was taking the eyes of their staff off their competitors, the other businesses, and actually making them look internally and become envious and guarded against each other's. Well, take something very different, reality television. How many of you remember 20 years ago, The Truman Show? This fascinating program in which Jim Carrey was the kind of star, in which he thought he was living his life, but in fact he was on a TV set. And everybody else in his life, including his wife, were actors. And people were watching the things that he did, and he had no idea about that. Some people say it gave rise to reality TV. Other people just say it anticipated reality TV. But around the same time, we got Big Brother, started in Holland. And then you remember first program, I think, was about 1999 over here, where the TV just watches people's lives and you have no privacy at all. And you pick up on all of the things that they say and their mistakes, as well as the good things as well. And then there has been an explosion. I mean, part of the reason for this reality TV is it's so cheap. You know, if you do a drama, it costs a fortune to put on. But if you just have a few cameras in a house watching people, and it's amazing how much time people will spend watching this kind of stuff. You know, they're sleeping in their beds at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the people are at home with the TVs on just to see if anything happens, you know. And so it goes on, The Only Way is Essex and Love Island, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and all these different programs. And of course, more recently, it's kind of reality TV, it's the Jeremy Kyle show, where you kind of watch this underclass of people who've made a complete pig's ear of their lives and have a good laugh at their misfortune. What interested me was there was somebody I think it was Newsnight recently, who produces reality TV programs. And he said there's a rule in it. fundamentally, and as I sort of unbuttoned what he was saying, fundamentally, the program tries to appeal to either your pride or your envy. So if you watch it and you feel two things, then it's successful because it will draw you in. One is envy. I wish I were them. You know, might be I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. It might be all those beautiful people on Love Island or something like that. You know, you watch it because you wish you could be in their shoes. And the other extreme is pride. I'm glad I'm not like that. And it's kind of Jeremy Kyle. You watch the Jeremy Kyle show and think, oh, for goodness sake, thank goodness I'm not that person. You know, how stupid can you be? And very cleverly, reality TV taps into those two attitudes that we have, pride and envy. And if it's not doing that, if people are too ordinary and you don't have any strong feelings, then it doesn't work. People stop watching it. So after a while, Big Brother had a random set of people on, and then they were being checked, carefully chosen so that they would kind of rub off each other and annoy each other, and it would kind of get you going and kind of get you interested and into the whole thing. Now back to the story of David. What we frequently miss in this story is that David wasn't just a bit more gifted than Saul. God was with David. That's what the chapter says. David's success is attributed to the Lord, not to some list of outstanding inherent abilities that he had. And Saul, instead of nursing his damaged ego, could have recognized that the anointing had shifted and helped manage David's rise to power. Even his son and heir, Jonathan, wasn't opposing it. He quickly saw that the hand of God was with David, and as we'll see next week, said to David that the throne in the future would be his. Well, there we are. Power, envy, jealousy, pride. It will be interesting to spectate as umpteen Tory ministers now scramble for the top job. All of them will declare that they are motivated by a sense of public duty. But I wonder, in the corridors of Westminster, I suspect that pride and envy are well-honed tools, for the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. What's the opposite of envy? Contentedness, benevolence, generosity. Paul talked in his letter to the Philippians about learning the secret of contentment, and Jesus chose the path of servanthood, a path that would ultimately lead him to a cross. So this morning I ask you the question, what matters more to you, that you should succeed or that the kingdom should come? That your bank balance should be overflowing or that you should make other people rich? That you should be happy or that your life should put a smile on the face of those around you? Lois was reminding me of a story that we heard some years ago. And I can't remember the exact details of the story, so I'll kind of rewrite it, but it's the same point that I'm trying to make. It's the story of a traveller who travelled somewhere in the world and came across a man living a very simple life, and they spent a few days together. And after a few days, this ordinary man, a local native of the area, came out with an amazing diamond. It was a huge diamond. It was uncut, but nonetheless, it was a large diamond that would be fabulously valuable. And the traveller, who was quite a rich man, remarked on it. In fact, even offered to buy it from the man. And the man said, "You don't need to buy it from me. I valued our 2 days of friendship together. You can have it. Just take it." Now, I can't remember the details of whether the rich man took it there and then or quite how it worked out. But this is what the rich man later said. "What struck me was not so much that he gave me the diamond for nothing. What struck me is that the spirit that he had that enabled him to be so generous and open-handed." That's the thing that we need to strive for. That's the thing that we're called to. The world may be driven by jealousy and envy, But we are called to be generous and open-handed and kind. So I'll finish with the words of Ignatius of Loyola, one of the church fathers. Teach us, good Lord, to serve you as you deserve, to give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labour and not to ask for any reward, save that of knowing that we do your will.